The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content.
Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
To be something that I want to make or how I want to be, I pump it in my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
I jump into my SparkFile.
Welcome to the Spark File, your alpha and omega for creative inspiration.
I'm Laura Camion.
How douchey is that? And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're an OG listener, welcome back, Sparkler. If you're joining us for the first time, we welcome you, but you may be asking yourself, what exactly is a Spark File? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are such good questions, and we do have answers.
A Spark File is a place where you consistently collect all your inspirations and fascinations.
And here's the deal. We are makers who make all kinds of things.
If you're anything like us and you're making stuff all the time, or you would like to be making stuff all the time, you know the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry.
Holla. So we're on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this podcast.
Or an awareness of our own body and mind's response.
Mm. Or a framework for understanding your own creative journey.
Ooh, every episode we're going to reach into the Spark File and we're going to exchange some sparks. And from time to time, we're going to talk to some folks who spark us too.
And if you're not careful, you might just enter the cave you fear and access the treasure that you seek. So without further ado, let's open up
the spark file.
Camion.
Blackwell. Oh,
Camion.
What?
Camion.
Blackwell.
There was more Forrest Fenn news. Did you see that?
What? No, I didn't see anything this week. What happened?
Okay. Camion, I meant to look this up before we got into this conversation. Please bear with me while I real time. Oh no, there's even more Forrest Fenn news.
What?
It's so funny. I just wanted to bring up an article to share the there's an article on Inside Edition that says Forrest Fenn announced his treasure was found, but CBS anchor Tony DeCupil says that may not be the case. What?
For real? Or is that that one person stirring up trouble saying, I don't know if this is
true? It's not that same woman. It's a CBS This Morning anchor who says, I think the treasure is 100% real. I don't, however, think it's been found.
Why would Forrest Fenn say that it had?
So subsequently, since our last episode, I don't know if you've seen, but Forrest Fenn posted these photos of himself. He shared three photos of what he said were the chest. And like he said, it's darker than it was when he left it on the ground and walked away. And he showed a picture of him wearing a bracelet that seems to have aged, you know, with time. But this CBS anchor is saying that the photos aren't proof that the treasure has been found, noted that the pictures are undated, taken in an unnamed location. And I'm sort of like, yes, I agree with him. When I saw the article and I saw Forrest Fenn with the treasure box, I was like, that doesn't prove that it's been found. It just proves that Forrest Fenn is in a picture with this treasure. So it's not like he's holding up a picture of today's paper in front of the treasure. Do you know what I mean?
That is true.
So I don't know. I think it's still a little bit of a mystery. More on the story as it develops.
This is crazy because he said that it had been found and the anonymous person back east who found it. I thought they just used a photo of him with the chest, like, because they weren't going to, you know, have a photo of the person back east, the finder of it.
I agree with you, but I don't disagree with what the CBS anchor is saying, which is, it's not really proof just because we've seen these pictures And he says, look, it's age. It doesn't, I don't think it's proof either. Which is, I was thinking about this more. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, like, wait, so there's Forrest Fenn in these photos saying it's age?
Yes.
So you're saying that.
Which doesn't make sense to me. Why wouldn't it be with the, why wouldn't it be with the person who found it? It doesn't, unless they all had dinner together. Like, we need more information.
We need more info.
We need more information. Anyway.
Fascinating.
That's a very slightly disappointing update. But an update nonetheless. Cams, do you have anything? Oh, Camian, I've got another one for you.
What?
When we were talking about how this household has started to watch Alone.
Yes. Oh, I've got to tell you something about that.
Okay, what I didn't realize, you were like, is it the most recent season? And I was like, yeah, it's the most recent season. I'm watching season 6. You were talking about season 7.
That's correct. So, I was going to tell you that.
Yes.
Yes.
So there were things that I learned talking to you that I was very careful not to say in front of the other watchers in my household because I thought it'd be fun if we arrived at them in real
together.
Time. But we finished season 6 and now we're going back to the beginning and we're checking in with season 1.
Oh, I'm so envious that you get to like live all of that. I can't wait till you get to season 7. There's one season that I'm going to tell you, I'll warn you in advance. They tried something, I don't know if it's season 4 or 5, but they, or 3 or 4, they tried something where it was like pairs. So essentially it was like you got dropped off in one place, your partner got dropped off in another, you had to find your way to each other and then set up your camp. I didn't watch all of that season. I had accidentally skipped it for some reason and then came back to discover it, you know, and came back to it and was like, oh, here's a season I haven't seen. And I just didn't get into it as much as the others. I have no
reason. One of the things I love about the show, honestly, is it's, don't get me wrong, I don't think it's simple to produce that show, but I love the straightforwardness and the there's sort of a clean simplicity to the rules of that show that it's not – even the fact that they made a choice, part of me wished that they would show you what 10 assets the person chose to bring.
Yes, yes.
You know, but part of me loves that you're just sort of like – it is so straightforward. It is so man against man – pardon me, man against himself, man against nature.
Yes.
Or shall I say person against himself, person against nature. There's something that's so beautiful about the sort of sleek simplicity of it that I don't, I'll go dig online if I need to know what 10 items that person chose to bring.
Yeah. You know what? Come to think of it, they probably do have that stuff online. And I've never looked for it, but you're right. Sometimes I'll be so curious because someone will say, I didn't bring like a flint stick because I'm good at making fire. I'm like, okay.
Best wishes. Hey, but it gave me a spark for a birthday present for Nathan, which is we're watching that show. And he said, you know, I've always wanted those. They're called like barrel sticks or something. They're fire starters. He's like, I've always wanted one of those. I've never had one. And I was like, good birthday spark.
That's good birthday spark. Oh, yeah. I love it. I'm so happy that you are watching it. I'm so thrilled. Yeah, but I realized it once I turned it on. I went to look on Netflix because I'm watching it on Prime. And I said to Wes, I was like, Susan said they're watching it on Netflix. We should go over there. And
I was like,
oh, it's season 6.
Yeah. It's season 6. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to spoil anything for anybody.
No,
but
you don't want that.
I can't. I just won't say anymore because I don't want to spoil anything for anybody.
That was a tease.
But there, when we'll speak offline.
Okay, we will speak offline about
Did you remember what you wanted to say about something?
I don't remember. I remember coming across some news and thinking, oh, we could do a whole episode of like updates on our previous sparks, but no. I can't remember.
Somebody on social media was like, I love update episodes. And I was like, they were talking about how they loved hearing updates from past, episodes, which I thought was fun. And somebody's paying attention. Thank you, listeners, for paying attention.
Yay.
Should we dig into our own Forest Bend treasure of sparks?
We should. I think I'm going first today. Is that correct?
I think you are.
All right. Well, Sue, speaking of digging deep, I dug deeper this week into my recent fascination with how all the things that we are grappling with in 2020 are affecting us mentally and physically and emotionally. My friend, we are living in some really rapidly changing times.
It is no joke, Camion. It is a daily personal investigation.
It's astonishing because if you do just a little bit of Googling, just a little research, there were articles in January and February of this year that were about fatigue and kind of emotional crisis and the effect of 2020 on us. And I was like, that was January. That was nothing, but it was already so much, you know?
Yeah.
So I am so sparked when I just start to ruminate and consider the immediate and long-term repercussions of it all. I began to think about how, like, in history books, and you know, I like to read about history. But the mental state, like the mental state of being that people were in at any given time that you're reading about, it's typically summed up like in one sentence or even like a phrase as part of a sentence. Things like tensions were high due to excessive unemployment, or people lived in fear of the Black Plague. But at least in my education, we didn't often stop to like unpack that. And what does that really mean? How did that tension or those fears play out in their daily lives? How were they emotionally impacted on a day-to-day basis?
Maybe this is why historical fiction is so delicious to some, because you, instead of just sort of like, on this date, this battle occurred, it is a deeper dive into what those experiences are really like for individuals and for communities of people.
No, you're right. That definitely. And I love watching that stuff, like, especially if it's filmed and it's brought to life. It's so, I'm often like, oh, I never really thought about like, they had to do that every day. And that took 2 hours every day. You know, like I'll just be fascinated by the various like day-to-day details of their life.
Yeah.
But I've been thinking about how, you know, haven't read much. We've read so much about the flu of 1918, but not so much about the psychological effects. I suspect that they didn't study that enough to like be able to really,
it'd be more like a collection of anecdotal evidence. It strikes me while you're speaking that it's not just historical fiction. It's any time a story is told, you know, like a story, some historical story is told, even if it's a documentary that captures, because people, whether it's a community of people, whether it's a race of people, whatever group of people it is, it's not monolithic. Within that group of people, there are going to be all sorts of different experiences happening.
That's right. We're not in the same boat, but we're in the same storm. So when you talk about the Great Depression, or you talk about other crises that happened, you're right. And that's probably why the history books just can't get into great detail. If you're trying to learn about something in an overall and general sense, they can't get into the different variances between groups of people and what their daily experience was like. And, you know, it gets summed up in a sentence. And
yes, but this is why, and we've talked about this before, I have difficulty learning history unless it has some sort of storytelling and emotion and visceral feeling attached to it.
You are not
alone. And the minute it has that, then I can wrap my mind around it.
You're not alone. And I think that's honestly, that's how I became interested in history, was like viewing things in the History Channel, not to be like totally cliche, but watching things and seeing them truly come to life, and not necessarily from textbooks, you know. And my, my sweet niece, who I love so much, said to me the other day, and I think I told you, like, it nearly cracked my heart in two, but she was like, I hate history. I'm sorry, excuse me, what did you say? She's like, oh, I hate history. And then I think she saw my face. She was like, I mean, I hate my history class. It's not great.
But I hear that. And I was like, was it Bailey who said that?
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Bailey. We love you.
Hi, Bailey.
The thing about that's, I relate deeply to that, because what I'm hearing Bailey say behind I hate history is I can't get inside of this.
Yeah,
the way that these stories are being shared, I'm having a hard time getting inside of this.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And I think what pains me, and I'm sure many other creative people, is that could there be an easier subject to actually bring to life, to tell stories and to do it in a variety of ways? I can't imagine. Like, you can't do that with math, but you can do it with history. And so I just think it's almost criminal to be a history teacher and not really work to bring stories to life.
This is another spark for another day, mm-hmm. but I will tell you, I've been having these conversations with my sister, who is a chemistry teacher in a STEAM school.
Yes.
And so she's collaborating with her colleagues who teach fine arts and things like that to find ways to weave this learning together. And she and I talk about, with something like chemistry, how storytelling is essential to teaching, to learning, and to also conveying complex or slippery chemistry ideas to the layperson. So I'm going to say it is part of math, and it's part of chemistry, and it's part of all those things as well.
It is. But what I'm saying is, like, those teachers have to take that initiative, because it currently isn't a requirement that it be taught that way. But
correct,
it will be way more efficient. You know, what I'm saying is, history is the easiest. I mean, it's like a no-brainer. You're going to sit in a history class and not tell a story, you know. But for other subjects, I think the teachers have to show even more initiative and say, I want to cross-pollinate, you know, what we're trying to learn in chemistry with these other classes and disciplines.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I envy people who can metabolize that information without having to have a story wrapped around it. I envy them. I am not one of those people. I wish
I was. Me neither. Yeah. I don't know if I wish I was or not, but I'm not one. It just is what it is. Maybe life is easier for them, or maybe not. I don't know.
I feel like learning might be easier. Yeah, there's a spark for
That's a spark right there. So here in 2020, I think about this on a daily basis, honestly, this long-term repercussions of everything of 2020 so far. And I've talked to so many creative friends recently, filmmakers, writers, sculptors, painters, and I've asked, like, how are you feeling? How's everything going? What, if anything, are you creating? And across the board, the answer has been zilch. Nada. They talk about being depleted of ideas or depleted of motivation. And I gotta say, same. I know that there are a lot of people, maybe not a lot, I don't know, I can't quantify it. I know there are some people out there right now creating and making. And to you, I say, we love it. Keep going.
Yes.
Please don't stop. If you've got the juice to run on, please keep running with it. You can lead the charge for the rest of us. But for many of us, I think these scary and strange and interesting and even sometimes encouraging times that we're living in are a roller coaster of emotions and mental and physical responses, personally. Mm-hmm. I do think, thankfully, that we have more awareness on mental health and what we need as humans at this point in history, as well as more research on what the effects of quarantines and civil rights movements and pandemics have on a population of people, maybe we don't have so many examples of all of them happening at the same time, but we do have some data and some basic understanding of the psychological toll. According to an article in the LA Times, research suggests that people forced to live in quarantine conditions face a greater risk of anxiety, depression, anger, irritability, insomnia, and post-traumatic stress symptoms. The longer a quarantine lasts, the worse its impact on psychological well-being. And the authors found that the key stressors that lead to psychological distress include boredom, frustration, inadequate supplies, limited information, and financial loss. And that those effects can linger long after life returns to normal.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes. So everywhere you look, you can read about this like extended period of stress, from healthcare workers working overtime, trying to care for everyone, to other essential workers pulling overtime in grocery stores or production plants to keep up with demand. Delivery drivers putting themselves in danger, parents at home working and caring for their kids at the same time, or people being laid off and furloughed, worried about finances and when they'll be able to be employed. Mm. And all of that is exhausting. In addition to it, if you are an empathetic or sensitive person, even if all of those things are not happening to you personally, they are finding there's a very real thing called compassion fatigue that is affecting all of us.
Mm.
Compassion fatigue. According to an article on Bustle.com, compassion fatigue is often defined as a general state of physical and mental exhaustion caused by continued exposure to other people's trauma. It's often experienced by caregivers, aid workers, doctors, and others who deal with trauma on a daily basis. Symptoms include feelings of hopelessness, insomnia, nightmares brought on by the stress associated with hearing or seeing distressing situations over and over. I mean, does that not describe our news cycle?
Yeah.
It's one distressing situation, you know, over and over and over again. And it's as though the media is trying to find the most unique distressing story that we haven't heard yet, you know. So you might have heard of these people having stressful situations, but you haven't heard of these people.
And it also just makes me think of those, sorry to interrupt you.
No,
it makes me think
okay.
of those frontline healthcare workers who are just going through it, through it.
Yes. And all the people who know they're going through it, who are, you know, whether it's in New York at 7 p.m. trying to show appreciation, it's because everyone has them on their minds and are thinking about the trauma that they're going through. And so not comparing those traumas, but still the person who's not going through the trauma but is having compassion fatigue is because, like, in their mind, they're trying to live through what it might be like for the person who's actually living through it. Mm. It's not a particularly helpful thing, but as compassionate people and empathetic people, we have to accept that we do deal with that. And the more we allow those stories of distress into our lives, the more we're going to feel that as well. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that like a bad thing, because I do think empathy is crucial and we need to be learning about each other's stories and listening and all of that. But how can we do it in a way that isn't like bringing on this overload?
I hear you. And it's one of the reasons why I've talked about this before. Just like I am just very conscious of a little bit of a news diet.
Yes.
I've heard other people filter it out I was speaking with a fellow teaching artist yesterday, and they were talking about how they only read their news. And that's one way that they can filter stuff out.
Yeah.
But great. Having some sort of a smart filter in place, so you're still informed, but not going into overwhelm or compassion fatigue.
That's right. And trying to feel all the feelings for everyone at all times.
Right.
Another thing I learned about for all the people working from home or trying to keep up a social life from home, another new fatigue that has been identified is Zoom fatigue. which really applies to any of the screen-related interfaces like Google Hangout, yeah. Skype, and FaceTime, and House Party, yeah. et cetera. An article in the National Geographic describes how difficult virtual interactions can be on the brain. Because humans communicate even when they're quiet, during an in-person conversation, the brain focuses partly on the words being spoken, but it also derives additional meaning from dozens of nonverbal cues, such as mm-hmm. whether someone is facing you or slightly turned away, if they're fidgeting while you talk, or if they inhale quickly in preparation to interrupt. These cues help paint a holistic picture of what's being conveyed and what's expected in response from the listener. And since humans evolved as social animals, perceiving these cues comes naturally to most of us. It takes little conscious effort to parse and can lay the groundwork for emotional intimacy. But since like a video call doesn't allow us to pick up those typical clues, but it mm-hmm. doesn't keep our brain from looking for them. So the whole time our brain is constantly searching.
Seeking.
Yes, it's active while we're.
It's like when your phone battery, when you're out of cell phone range and your phone keeps seeking cell phone range so the battery drains really fast.
That's exactly right. We are seeking. We are searching. We're looking for these minute facial expressions and clues from other people that we cannot get through Zoom. And when we get off the call, we're exhausted. Our brain is literally exhausted from it. It's wearing everyone down. Hmm. I also learned of another fatigue we're experiencing, Suze, caution fatigue. This one I think of as like the little little, just want to give you a little warning. And everyone's like, ugh, not another one. The little boy who cried wolf, right? This little boy who cried wolf fatigue. We've been cautioned so much about COVID-19 and the risks. We are literally tired of hearing about it. According Time Magazine, that's right. And probably at the time when in many cases we need to hear about it most right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But according to Time Magazine, the phrase was coined by Jacqueline Golan from Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine based on her 15 years of research into depression, anxiety, and decision-making. Golan likens social distancing motivation to a battery. When lockdowns were first announced, many people were charged with energy and the desire to flatten the curve. Now, many weeks / months into this shut down. The prolonged cocktail of stress, anxiety, isolation, and disrupted routines has left many people feeling drained. And as motivation dips, people are growing more lax about social distancing guidelines and potentially putting themselves and others in harm's way.
Yep.
I mean, I just think about that when you get so taught, like, there's a law of like diminishing returns. You can't take in any more warnings.
But I know that sometimes also I'll just be like, you know what? I just like to go to fill in the blank. Now, some of these places aren't open in my state, but I just think, what would be the harm? Just like a little visit to fill in the blank.
That's right.
I almost have to remind myself because on some level I've shut down to the warnings.
That's right.
I have to remind myself that we're still in it.
You know what? I didn't put this in my spark, but this reminds me of something else in that article where they talk about like your brain gives more credence to your personal experience than it does to incoming information. So if your personal experience is, well, I haven't gotten sick yet, right?
Like this
entire time I'm doing this, I haven't gotten sick. So it's weighing the fact that you have not gotten sick against this like new warning that you have like caution fatigue from anyway. And it is trying to assess like what is the real danger. And a lot of times the brain will conclude, unless we like really force it to take in that warning again, and like you said, remind yourself correctly with like what's the information that I know? It hasn't actually changed since 3 months ago, and I still need to be as cautious as I was.
Yes, and I will say that because we weight and value our lived experience more than the information that comes externally, friends of ours who have been sick are just like, they're pulling their hair out because they're like, what yes. are people thinking?
What are they
Why
doing?
Would they be so reckless?
That's
because
right.
they've lived through it. They've lived
That's
through
right.
the pain and the agony of being, of having coronavirus. And
to
so they're sort of,
it.
That's right. So their lived experience, they're just like shaking their head, but everybody is sort of viewing it through the lens of their own lived experience.
It's so true. And it's yeah. really, really hard to get people to consider otherwise. And you could predict this, you know, when we were like, oh, the shutdown. So if we shut down and actually succeed, you know, there are going to be people who say
that was
unnecessary. That was a lot for nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Except that it's like, no, it was, that's exactly
that
why
success.
We did it. And
yep.
we succeeded.
Yep.
Success looks like nothing happening. That's
yes.
like something to yeah. cheer about. So Suze, in medical news today, can you get a sense of the rabbit hole I went down? In
yes.
medical news today, I learned about GAS. That's right, GAS, G-A-S, General Adaptation Syndrome. And this one really resonated for me. It's been around forever, but I think what got me was the word adaptation, because mm-hmm. I think that's really all each of us are trying to do every day. We're just trying to adapt to the new circumstances of our life.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
the change is happening so quickly that it's a constant adaptation to something new.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, all in all, every one of us is dealing with a variety of high stress situations. And like we said just a minute ago, like we're not all in the same boat, but we are in the same storm. So GAS, General Adaptation Syndrome, is a three-stage process that our bodies go through when we're exposed to stress. And like I said, this was true before and has been around, but it's just all more heightened now. The three stages of GAS are alarm reaction, resistance, followed by exhaustion. An alarm reaction, yeah. I mean, I was like, oh my God, I totally see how I got to where I am now. But the alarm reaction stage is like, you know, this is the one we know about. The distress signal is sent to the brain. It triggers the release of adrenaline and cortisol. Our heart rate goes up. Our blood pressure goes up. Our blood sugar levels go up. This is the well-documented like fight or flight or freeze reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But phase two then is resistance. And during the resistance stage, the body tries to counterbalance the alarm reaction and return the body to normal by reducing the amount of cortisol. But if the stressful situation, like if the stress comes to an end, the body will mm-hmm. return to normal and it's fine.
But if it persists,
the body will stay in a state of alert. The stress hormones will continue to be produced. And this can lead to a person like struggling to concentrate, becoming irritable. And then finally, phase three, which is the exhaustion stage. Again, according to medical news today, after an extended period of stress, the body goes into the final stage of GAS, known as exhaustion. And at this stage, the body has depleted its energy resources by continually trying but failing to recover from the initial alarm reaction. So this entire time, our bodies have been like working so hard to be like, I'm trying to get back to normal. I'm trying to get back to normal. I'm trying to get back to normal, only mm-hmm. to be like, okay, I don't have any more resources to put towards getting back to normal. I'm just
mm-hmm. And again, that
done.
Cell phone battery gets drained because it's
That's
like
right.
I'm seeking normal.
Can't find
until it.
It
just drains itself out. I just want to say this is so fascinating to me. And when Emily Fletcher, my great meditation teacher.
Yeah.
Hi, Emily. When Emily teaches meditation, the language that she uses around like, why do we meditate? We don't meditate to get good at meditation. We
mm-hmm.
meditate so we can get good at life and living.
Yes.
But she talks about how those two meditations a day, so I do like 20 minutes in the morning when I wake up and 20 minutes before the evening meal at some
mm-hmm.
point, is replenishing adaptation energy. That's the language that she uses. Yeah.
Susan,
so I'm psyched that I have that practice in place
it's helping you.
I have never needed it more to be able to combat what you're talking about here, where this general adaptation syndrome. Yep. I'm amazed there's a name for it. Amazing.
There's a name for it. And I mean, it is so interesting to me too, that there is a name for it, because, you know, it's something that we just kind of take for granted, but it is naming the physiological responses that your body has. So this isn't about you like needing to wake up with a better attitude. This is about like your body is going through this. It's going through a chain reaction that, you know, unless you do things to try to decrease the stress level, it's going to do that because it's trying to take care of you. And meditation is one of those ways that you can disrupt and give it some support and help. But if a person does not find ways to manage the stress levels at this stage, this is when you get more at risk of developing more long-term stress-related illnesses. That could be stomach ulcers, type 2 diabetes, depression, and ironically, a greater risk of viral infection. So a virus like COVID-19, you'll be more susceptible. So on sharpbrains.com, they further explore this third state of exhaustion, saying if the stress-causing events continue, neurological exhaustion can set in. This phenomenon came to be referred to as burnout in our popular culture. It's a state of mind characterized by a loss of motivation or drive and a feeling that you're no longer effective in your work. And when this mental exhaustion sets in, because otherwise we'd cry.
We recognize.
And when this mental exhaustion sets in, a person feels emotionally flat, can become cynical, and may display a lack of responsiveness to the needs of others. Suze, I think what I'm trying to say in my spark is that I feel all of it. I feel all of it. Like as I was doing this research, every single one of these fatigues and syndromes spoke to me.
I got all these fatigues.
I do. I have
got fatigue. I've collected the entire set. You have fatigue.
I have fatigue. I'm tired of being tired. I think everyone is. And I'm really craving the refilling of the pond.
Yeah.
And I know why I was feeling this way, you know. And that was like comforting on some level to understand the why and understand what's happening in my body. That's comforting, but it also kept underlining something that I know, but I often neglect. And that is what I need to make of it. It's become clear to me that making space for self-care and stress reduction is not a good to have. It is a must have. Yeah. Like during all of this, we must make time for rest. We must make time for restoration and rejuvenation. There's no doubt that everything we've experienced in 2020 thus far is changing the way our brains work and the way our bodies work. And we must make room for understanding those implications and taking care to keep our minds and bodies as healthy as possible. It's like you've always said, Suze, like our health, our collective health has to come first. It's the only way that
we
can give to others, to be of service, or to create. So that sparked me, and I started to think about a shift mentally into rejuvenation. And when I think of rejuvenation, I often think of being outside among the trees. And this reminded me of our favorite poet, Ms. Mary Oliver, and her poem, When I Am Among the Trees. When I am among the trees, especially the willows and the honey locust, equally the beech and the oaks and the pines, they give off such hints of gladness. I would almost say they save me, and daily. I am so distant from the hope of myself, in which I have goodness and discernment, and never hurry through the world, but walk slowly and bow often. Around me, the trees stir in their leaves and call out, stay a while. The light flows from their branches. And they call again It's simple, they say, and you too have come into the world to do this, to go easy, to be filled with light, and to shine. So, Suze, when I'm rested, I plan to do some writing, but at this moment, I think I am giving myself permission to restore and replenish and rejuvenate. I think it's mandatory.
I love it, Camian. What a beautiful spark. And it's going to be a really good complement to my spark.
Oh.
I have lots of thoughts and lots of things to share.
Great. I can't
but
wait.
But first, I've got to pee. Wow. What? That is an amazing, right on the money, right on time spark.
My fatigue.
Yeah, your fatigue. And I just want to respond. I see your spark and I raise you this spark. My spark sources today include an article on Oprah.com and the work of a person named Elizabeth Lesser, a talk given by the aforementioned Emily Fletcher.
Hi, Emily Fletcher.
On ZivaMeditation.com, there's a great self-care center on ZivaMeditation.com that I highly recommend. It's free. It's great. Check it out. And some thoughts that Camian and I have developed in our own work. So Camian, you're one of my spark sources today.
Hey,
good job.
Hey, that's a first.
Yeah. There
I'm
you
proud.
Go.
I'm really proud.
So my, wait till you hear what I have to say. JK, I think you'll be proud. My spark today is all about cycles, cycles of life, cycles of change, cycles of creativity. There are so many ways that cycles of life and change are represented in mythology and religion and creativity. And if you've taken a class with us, you know that we have our very own spark cycle, which is sort of the life cycle of creativity. Because little baby Cams and I realized after decades of participating in various creative projects in a variety of configurations and collaborations that every little spark of an idea that reaches maturity seems to flow through this spark cycle of creativity. Creativity may not always flow in the order that I'm about to present to you, but there are essentially three phases of creativity that Laura and I have identified. One, generating sparks. Two, fanning those sparks into flames. And three, sharing the light. Mm-hmm. So let me unpack that for you. Some of you listeners, this will be fresh. Camian, you already know this. You helped invent this. You just have to sit back, relax, and enjoy. If you have anything to add, please feel free. So the first phase that I mentioned, generating sparks, is a phase of cultivation. In this phase, we are consciously generating ideas. We are listening. We are actively seeking. We are leaning into those things that fascinate us and inviting those things in. I think this also includes daydreaming and meditating and cultivating a mindset of continual learning and curiosity. Ideally, we want this to be a phase that you can access by choice and that you keep spark generation active, not passive. So you're not going to be one of those people that's sort of like, when the muse hits me every 5 years, then I sit down and I write a poem. You're going to be somebody who is sort of actively seeking spark generation in a curious, forward-footed way. Does that sound right, Cams? Did I get all that?
It sounds right. And I want to add something to it that I've not said before, but I think our
Say
whole
it out
podcast
loud, Cam,
is
man.
About it. But I've just Say it noticed how fun it is. Like when you have a backpack full of sparks and you're in conversation with people and you can just, you know, reach back and grab a few and get literally give them freely. It's like the free exchange of ideas. It feels so good. Then someone is like, really? Can I? And I'm like, yes, you do it. I'm not, that's just in my backpack right now.
I'm not doing that.
You know, it's such a gift. And I think that if we all creatively were more open to just sharing the ideas, the ones you're not using right now, the ones you don't plan to use anytime soon, let them free. Let them free.
I love that. And I think you're right. I think it is the foundation of this whole podcast. And I'm proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as the conversational turn-taking is balanced, it makes you a great cocktail party guest because you've got tons of sparks to share.
So good. And you never know what they're going to say to you in return that can spark something else, you know, that you're like, oh, great, I'll take that one.
That's right.
Great.
So the next phase is fanning the flames. This phase is all about creation. It's where the idea goes from a spark and it gets fanned into that creative flame. It's where the real making occurs. It's creating something in a space where nothing existed before. Mm-hmm. So it's taking that little baby spark of inspiration and it's making it a creative reality. Anything to add to that, Cams?
I just like to underline something like that. Making something where there was nothing before. I mean, what feels better than that? I don't know. I just like, I always love when we talk about that because to me, that really is creation. Like you set your script down on the table and you're like, here is a script, here's a screenplay. This didn't exist before. These words and this combination, never in the history of the world has this ever existed before. And I don't know. I just think there's something so powerful and so exciting about that creation phase, making it happen.
Love that. Love that. So then we flow into sharing the light. This phase is all about communication and sharing out. And this may look like sharing an idea, a little spark of an idea that you have, or literally sharing what you've made. So it could be anything from a pitch for a TV pilot to the actual airing of the TV show, to a dance piece, to a piece of woodwork or a recipe you've created and posted on your blog. That's all sharing the light. Anything else about that, Cans?
I think just that people can make an entire career out of sharing the light. If you get good at pitching ideas, some people don't ever make them, but they know how to sell an idea and do that over and over and over again.
And I think I might be mistaken. Listeners, correct me if I'm wrong, but sometimes that can create an imbalance where if you're just sharing, having sparks of ideas, developing them and sharing the light with ever fully getting to see them realized, that imbalance can cause problems for people over time because it can be really, really unsatisfying. Something we do like to say as well is you can share your work or not share your work. That really is up to you. But if you do or if you don't, we would just love for you to check in with yourself and make sure that it's born out of choice and not out of fear. So that's another little piece of that. I think I speak for both of us when I say we also feel that the stronger we've gotten in each of these areas and the more balance there is amongst these mindsets or phases, the more rich and satisfying and sustainable our creative lives have become.
True.
And it bears mentioning that sometimes people are really good at one or more of these phases, but not great at all of them. So you might be, for instance, a seasoned maker, but you're depleted when it comes to fresh ideas. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you have a million ideas, but you don't know how to make them reality. Or maybe you're great at making things, but not great about sharing those things or communicating your work out to others. Or like you were just saying, Cammie, and maybe you're great at talking about what you want to make or pitching, but you're not actually making it, so that imbalance can occur. We do believe that having a satisfying creative life often means having the ability to move fluidly between these phases or to be in all of these phases at any given time. But ideally, we're aiming for some sort of a balance, just some sort of a balance amongst these phases. So that's the spark cycle of creativity. But there are so, good job, Cammie. Good job, Susan.
That was genius.
Thanks. And thank you. But there are so many different types of frameworks and structures and myths and stories that attempt to capture various types of cycles that show up in our lives. So I found this very interesting piece by a woman named Elizabeth Lesser. And she talks about how the transformational journey is a voyage with 100 different names. It's sometimes called the Odyssey, the Grail Quest, the Great Initiation, the Death and Rebirth Process, the Supreme Battle, the Dark Night of the Soul, the Hero's Journey. All of these are names that describe the process of surrendering to a time of great difficulty, allowing the pain to break us open, and then being reborn, reborn stronger and wiser and kinder. So it's about transformation. It's about up-leveling. It's about evolution. I've heard my meditation teacher, Emily Fletcher, hi, Emily, talk about, that really should be a drinking game, talk about the cycles of creation, maintenance, and destruction.
Yes.
And these are cycles, creation, maintenance, and destruction, that are presented in the Vedas. And if you don't know, the Vedas are an ancient body of knowledge that is the foundation for things like acupuncture and feng shui and Ayurveda. Veda, the word Veda means knowledge, and specifically it's referring to the knowledge of nature. The Vedas are human interpretation of natural law. And if you're a student of the Vedas, it's all about getting in alignment with the flow of nature. That's why that Mary Oliver poem, I was like, yes, Laura Kamian, get in alignment with the flow of nature.
Yes.
Get up in it with those trees.
Yes.
As opposed to rigidly working against nature's flow. And as a result, having nature pummel you against the rocks, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like sometimes when you were speaking, Kamian, about like Zoom fatigue, and you know, we're all, many of us are working so hard, and we might, the sun has set and our eyes are still on a screen, and it's fucking with our sleep. And you know, that's just one of many, many, many examples. So I think your instinct to like be, go commune with the trees and commune with nature is a siren song that is beckoning you not to destroy you on the rocks, but to get you back in alignment with your natural flow and your natural rhythms.
I feel like I need to study the Vedas. I don't know. I'm being
girl,
pulled that
you know
way
you
right
can.
Now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you would love it, and I think Emily Fletcher may be a great teacher for you. Mm. So there's a spark for you. In the Vedas, they talk about, again, those cycles of creation, maintenance, and destruction. And we see this represented in mythology and religion, of course. In Indian mythology, the universe was created by Brahma, preserved by Vishnu, and destroyed by Shiva in preparation for the next creation.
Mm.
So these three gods, or three forms, or whatever you want to call them, acting as one, are called Trimurti, and they were all, they are all equal. And they keep balance. They keep that balance. But it seems like every religion includes stories of descent and rebirth, like Jonah from the whale, Jesus's death and resurrection, Siddhartha leaving the castle in order to become the Buddha. We have many, many versions of this hero's journey and of the cycles of life,
change,
and creativity. Yeah. So in her article, Elizabeth Lesser recounts a conversation between Bill Moyers and Joseph Campbell, who was a great interpreter of myths. If you haven't seen The Power of Myth or read Joseph Campbell's work, you are in for, oh my gosh, like a Forrest Fenn treasure trove of sparks. In 1988, the journalist Bill Moyers sat down with Joseph Campbell, and they did this whole series of interviews. And I'm telling you, Kamian, those interviews are jam-packed with sparks. That series called The Power of Myth is one of the most popular TV series in the history of public television. It is so good. It is so rich.
Yeah.
But in those interviews, Campbell talked about the hero's journey. And Joseph Campbell said, a legendary hero is usually the founder of something, the founder of a new age, the founder of a new religion, the founder of a new city, the founder of a new way of life, which sounds to me like a creative. They are they are creating some big new thing.
They made something,
They made something. And in response, Bill Moyers says to Joseph Campbell, but doesn't this leave all the rest of us ordinary mortals back on shore? And Campbell said, I don't think there is any such thing as an ordinary mortal.
Yes.
I always feel uncomfortable when people speak about ordinary mortals because I've never met an ordinary man, woman, or child. You might say that the founder of a life, your life or mine, if we live our own lives instead of imitating everybody else's life, comes from a quest as well.
So
what I think Joseph Campbell is saying is that while legendary stories may have heroes like the Knights of King Arthur searching for the Holy Grail, these legendary figures are acting as proxies. They're like storytelling proxies for each of us on our own hero's journey to seek and grow and change, whatever form that may take.
That's right.
And if you're consciously creating your own path, choosing how you want to build your own life, you are living a version of the hero's journey.
You are the hero.
Mm-hmm. You are the hero in your own hero's journey.
That's right.
But as is true in the hero's journey, in all of its forms, that quest can be painful. Certainly, we are all processing rapid change. Cam's roll clip on your spark. We are all processing rapid change in this rapidly changing world. And old systems are changing and breaking down. There is a spotlight being shown on systemic racism, unlike anything I have ever seen in my lifetime. And when I talk to my parents, they're like, and they lived through the 60s, and they're like, this is unlike anything we've ever seen.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And on one hand, I'm so excited by that change. And on the other hand, as I grapple with my own biases and privilege and ferret out my own racism, like deeply embedded racism and privilege, as I come to terms with that, that transformation becomes very real, and it's very painful and sometimes very shameful. And that's just one example of how we as individuals and we as a collective are changing and transforming right now.
So it's good.
In that talk that Emily Fletcher gave recently, she said, right now we are in a time of destruction. Our economy is changing. Some industries are being destroyed. Global systems are being destroyed. Our illusion of control is being destroyed. Our control was always an illusion, but it's scary to wake up to that understanding. Emily's getting fucking deep over there, but it's true. And she said, we will be changed on the other side of this. There is no question of that, but how will we be changed? Are we going to allow this to be a collective trauma? Or are we going to allow this collective experience to lead us to a mass awakening? Do we linger in the destruction, or do we instigate and celebrate the creativity that is coming?
Oh, so
I think
Emily.
We have a choice. Yeah, it's something that I've touched on in prior sparks, but we have a choice as to which way we're going to head. And I want to be proactive in my choice about how I want to process this and how I want to navigate all of this stuff that's coming, you know, down the pipe.
I feel thematically like we both have had sparks that were about like proactively choosing and not just letting it be decided for us. So this like feels really like a really powerful culmination of those conversations. Like it's just become, this is really crystallizing it for me, I guess. This is, this is an amazing spark. Amazing.
Good. Thanks. So Emily in her talk echoed something I've believed for a long time, which is there is no way around but through.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning some have been trying for decades or generations to avoid pain. But there is no way around but through. You really, this is a time, I believe, I'll just speak for myself, when I want to be leaning in and I want to be addressing, like surrendering to some of those things and really investigating them and learning from them.
Yeah.
I'm interested in leaning into that pain and in leaning into that change in order to make way for that transformation. When Camian and I teach about creativity, we teach people an approach to leaning into visceral feelings. And Cams, I will tell you, I have spent so much time thinking about this and practicing this leaning in. Mm-hmm. And yet I have to admit, I still struggle. When it comes time to lean into new, deeper discomforts, I brace against it. But again, if ever there was a time to lean in, it's now.
Mm-hmm.
So the following is a writing that's adapted from a book called Broken Open, How Difficult Times Can Help Us Grow. And again, this is by Elizabeth Lesser. I'm just going to straight up, Cams, I'm going to straight up read pieces of this article Elizabeth Lesser wrote.
Great.
I know we don't typically do that, but I feel like her words are right on the money. And if this speaks to you and you want to learn more, again, her book is called Broken Open. Her last name is spelled L-E-S-S-E-R. So look it up if this speaks to you. Elizabeth Lesser says, I have my own name for the quest. I call it the Phoenix Process, in honor of the mythic bird with golden plumage whose story has been told throughout the ages. The Egyptians called the bird the phoenix and believed that every 500 years, the phoenix bird renewed his quest for his true self. Knowing that a new way could only be found with the death of his worn-out habits, defenses, and beliefs, the phoenix built a pyre of cinnamon and myrrh, I'm sure that smelled delicious, sat down in the flames, and burned to death. Then he rose from the ashes as a new being, a strange amalgam of who he had been before and who he had become, a new bird, yet evermore himself, changed, and at the same time, the eternal phoenix. So again, these cycles, these sort of mythic cycles of, you know, whether it is creativity, maintenance, and destruction, or whether it's the phoenix passing through its life cycle, whether it's the spark cycle, like I'm feeling these cycles as a way to organize our thinking and also know that some of these things that we wrestle with, people have been wrestling with them since time immemorial.
And that's right.
We don't have to reinvent the cycle. We can, you know, we can walk in the footsteps of people that have come before us.
I'm loving that, like, there are scientific names for the things and there are mythical names, legendary names for the things. And they both point to, we're not alone. None of us is alone going through this. Like, these transformations have been made by people before us and our ancestors and our neighbors.
And we can learn from some of the skills that they arrived at. We don't have to, again, it feels like we're the only person that's ever lived through this and we're going through it for the first time, but we're not. So let's see what knowledge we can borrow from these people that went before us. I also just want to pause and say, I love the Phoenix myth. I love how it's represented so beautifully. J.K. Rowling, I know that you're going through some learning yourself right now, but I love how it's represented in Harry Potter with Fawkes, the Phoenix. Cams, did you ever take a dip into Harry Potter? Was that your jam or no?
I did. I watched all of them and I read them with Bailey when she was growing up. We did a little book club, she and I.
Oh my God. Hi, Bailey.
I know. Bailey.
But I love that you read those with her. But I love Fawkes the Phoenix in the Harry Potter books and in the movies. And according to the Harry Potter fan wiki, Fawkes was a highly intelligent phoenix and Albus Dumbledore's animal companion and defender. Fawkes's tears, which possessed healing properties, saved Harry Potter's life after his arm was punctured by the basilisk's fangs. Hey, spoiler alerts. And it also came to Dumbledore's aid in fighting Lord Voldemort during one of their battles. But one Fawkes scene that I especially loved is summarized in the Harry Potter fan wiki, which I'd like to read. Whilst in Albus Dumbledore's office for the first time, Harry Potter encountered Fawkes on his burning day. Fawkes appeared very ill, decrepit, and baleful, and much to Harry's initial shock and horror, burst into flames in front of his eyes. When Dumbledore entered, Harry explained to Dumbledore what had just happened to his bird, but Dumbledore calmly explained to Harry that Fawkes was a phoenix and thus was immortal, and that he had been looking dreadful for days. Dumbledore explained to Harry the various potent magical powers of the phoenix, and they both watched him rebirth from his ashes. I love that scene in the books. I love the scene in the movies. I love the very idea of it, that Harry's freaking out because he's like, holy shit, that bird just burst into flames. Did I break the bird? Like, it's such a great moment.
Right.
And then Dumbledore comes in and calmly says, oh no, he'd been looking dreadful for days. And this is his burning day. This is just a natural part of Fawkes's progression. And I just love the way she sort of wove that piece of mythology into this, you know, into this story.
Definitely.
So back to Elizabeth Lesser. According to Elizabeth Lesser, we are all the phoenix. And again, I'm just going to read straight from her work. Our lives ask us to die and to be reborn every time we confront change, change within ourselves and change in the world. When we descend all the way down to the bottom of loss and dwell patiently with an open heart in the darkness and pain, we can bring back up with us the sweetness of life and the exhilaration of inner growth. When there is nothing left to lose, we find the true self, the self that is whole, the self that is enough, the self that no longer looks to others for definition or completion or anything but companionship on the journey. I love it. And I have to tell you, when I have in the past, 24 hours, 48 hours, week, month, like when I get scared of confronting something, a hard truth about myself, a conflict with another person, when I read that, I'm sort of like, I can do this. It makes me braver because I think I can do this. Like I can take that pain and it will be tolerable for a finite amount of time, and I can be reborn.
That's right. It's so true that it isn't going to kill you. You know, we talked about this way back in that My Friend Fear spark. And obviously there are things that we fear that can kill us, but the fear itself and that
discomfort
isn't going to kill you. It's just going to feel uncomfortable. Yeah.
It's just going to feel uncomfortable. I have another spark for another day, but I just want to share a piece of it now, which is getting out of the habit of saying bad feelings or negative feelings and getting into the habit of saying uncomfortable feelings instead.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah. That's been helpful. So I want to share the steps of this Phoenix process. Elizabeth Lesser says the Phoenix process is a journey that is different for everyone. Therefore, ultimately, it is a trek into uncharted territory. It's not helpful to compare one person's journey to another's. All are different, and one is not more profound or important than the other. Very painful situations, the loss of a loved one, a serious illness, a national tragedy, have the power to transform one's life. But so do less traumatic events. It's all in the way we approach the changing nature of life. It's all in the courage to say yes to whatever comes our way. It's in the way we listen for messages in the flames and dig for treasure in the ashes, which reminds me very much of our Let Me Try That Again process. Like that reminds me very much of that. So these are Elizabeth Lesser's guidelines for the Phoenix process. Number one, change is the nature of life, and nothing changes without loss, which is a form of death. Loss and change, death and rebirth, these are natural, necessary cycles that no one can avoid or escape. Pretending otherwise is exhausting and a huge waste of time. To resist change, loss, or death is to say no to life. So that goes back to the Vedas and knowing that destruction is a part of the process.
Yes. That's right.
And to try to run from that, to try to prevent that is kind of a waste of time. It's kind of, you're fighting against nature.
It's a recipe.
You're bashing yourself against the rocks.
That's right.
So number two, it's not easy to participate consciously with change, loss, or death. More often than not, we would like to stay asleep to the whole subject. Oof. It hurts to lose and to change. It causes us grief, but grief is not a sign of anything being wrong, nor is it a sign of weakness. In fact, grief in the face of loss lubricates the wheels of change.
Wow.
When we turn towards what is changing, when we keep our hearts open and allow ourselves to feel a loss all the way through, we move with more grace into a new, energetic, and constructive phase of life. Mm-hmm. That to me is talking about like leaning into the pain of that phase of destruction and just feeling it fully. It's not going to be infinite. It's going to be finite. Sometimes I think people feel like it's going to go on forever and ever, or it's just going to put them in overwhelm. But to lean into it and let it move through us like a storm moves through and then moves on. And then it prepares us for the next phase, which is, if we learned anything from the Vedas, creation.
Yes, so, it's emotion. Yes. keeping it in motion, like
motion.
Keep it in motion. It's going to just roll right through you rather than resisting and persisting.
That's right. So here's Elizabeth Lesser's third guideline. We can transform loss into growth, change into insight, and suffering into joy if we turn and face what frightens us most about ourselves and our changing circumstances. But this takes courage. Mm. We may find aspects of our personality that need altering. We may find parts of our lives that can no longer remain the same. We may have to upset old family patterns. Mm-hmm. I'll add systemic racism in our country.
That's right.
We may have to adjust to different ways of thinking. We may have to let go of habits. Part of the Phoenix process is asking for help, learning new ways of doing things, and seeking inspiration. We may need help to learn how to take the suffering deep inside and to make the process an interior one. I think that's Elizabeth Lesser's way of saying this. Sometimes this work is an inside job.
Yes,
and you
indeed.
Have to, you know, you may need some help to do that work, but it is work that you need to do inside of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as we blame others, another person, an institution, a relationship for our faltering lives, there is little chance of transformation, little hope that we will be reborn as the powerful self that we really are.
Oof, that's the truth.
Yeah. It's, I feel like all of this, like this big transformational work that is afoot right now, we have got, if we hope to see that change happen and get to move from destruction into creativity, we have got to be willing to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
We have got to start with ourselves and we have got to do the work.
That's right.
Now back to Emily Fletcher in the Vedas. Emily said, according to the Vedas, Cams, yeah. This one goes out to you.
Okay.
This goes out to you and to the spark that you just shared. According to the Vedas, there is no such thing as good or bad. There is no such thing as right or wrong. There is just creation, maintenance, and destruction. And Emily proposes a thought experiment. What if instead of like good or bad, what if there's only creation, maintenance, and destruction? Like Shakespeare said in Hamlet, nothing is either good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. So it's just a little thought experiment. Like what if when you were talking about Camion, your fatigue.
Yes.
And your need to prioritize self-care, which I think if you're saying yes to self-care, you may have to say no to other things.
That's right.
What if that is just so? What if that is not good or bad? What if that is not a judgment on you? What if that's not a judgment on your productivity or your creativity, that it just is what it is?
I feel that. Like I was waiting for, I was like, well, now wait, how did that relate to my spark? Because I do feel that it is what it is, but you know, naming it and accepting it, name it to tame it. And so I'm okay with saying it's neither here nor there. I am fatigued. I'll say it. I think many people are, and it's okay to say what I need next is replenishment.
I'll tell you, maybe I'm projecting onto you.
Yeah.
When I think about destruction being a necessary part of the cycle of life or creativity, I'm sort of like, oh no. Oh no.
Oh, like, I don't want destruction to be. Uh-huh. And do you feel like fatigue is the destruction part? Yeah.
I think fatigue can be the result of the maintenance part.
Yeah.
Like, if you've been in maintenance for a long time.
Yes. And now we need to rebuild. Yes. Yes.
To that point, Emily says one way that humans seem to muck it up is this. This is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. We create, we like what we create, and then we want to try to hold on to it. But if we stop creating and innovating, that just puts us in maintenance, and we can get stuck in maintenance.
Uh-huh.
And she uses this metaphor, stagnant waters breed disease. So there are global systems that are no longer relevant right now, and nature is coming through with destruction.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. So if we linger too long in that maintenance place, then destruction is naturally hot on its heels, and creation goes to the back burner.
Or on a personal level, if we try to cling desperately to how things were without some releasing and being flexible to the idea that we can rebuild it in a new way. You can keep some of the things you loved about your life before, but it is changing, like it or not. So trying to hold on to it, I think, can be more painful and, you know, less helpful in the recreating.
Like, I think what Elizabeth Lesser is saying, it's saying no to life. It's saying no to the natural cycle of life and the natural cycle that nature wants to flow through.
That's right.
According to Emily, if you lead with maintenance, she said, you're essentially waving the flag of irrelevancy and saying, hey, nature, over here, bring on the destruction, clean house.
And then destruction
has to arrive to make way for creation because nature's going to keep on flowing.
Oh, my gosh.
According to Emily, if we lead with creation, we start to get more support, more of nature's support. We get in that flow state, synchronicity shows up, ease shows up, fresh ideas show up, sparks show up. And as many of us know, when we're not in flow state, everything does feel harder. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important to remember that maintenance, yes, creation, I mean, we love creation. We started a whole podcast around it. Right?
Yep.
But maintenance and destruction are natural and necessary parts of the cycle. So recognizing what season you're in and remaining in flow, not getting stuck in any part of the cycle because you fear the pain associated with change and transformation. I think that's the key.
I think
that's the key. Not getting stuck in any part of the cycle, or to frame it constructively, remaining in flow throughout the cycle.
I think that's what I feel like when, in terms of like being fatigued, I'm not wanting to get stuck here. I don't want to live indefinitely in fatigue. I want to rest and restore and replenish and rejuvenate and then on to the next. You know what I mean? Like, I recognize it as a natural next step in the process to not get stuck here in this like stress and fatigue moment.
1,000,000%. And I will speak for myself when I think it's fun to be the big old phoenix, like in full glory with your resplendent plumage.
Yes.
But I have to also be willing to live and work through the other phases in the process, the burning up, the time ashes, the resting, the rebirth, the reinvention, fresh creation.
That phoenix has to be willing to, like, everyone even sees it burn up. Everyone, it's like in plain sight of everyone. Of like,
yes,
and I'm out, you know?
Yeah.
But I will be back.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting. Yeah.
So we were talking with the writer, Michael R. Jackson, last week, and he described this time as a time of hibernation. To me, personally, it feels a little more active than that. Yes, there is an element of required rest, but I also think it's a time of a lot of listening and learning and investigation.
Yeah.
Old paradigms are being destroyed to make way for new creations on a larger societal level, but also on a personal level. Even with this project, the Spark File podcast and Camion, that's all I wrote. My paved road turned into a gravel road, turned into a grass path.
And led to some trees. That we can be among the trees. Oh, Suze, I think that's actually perfect that that's where the trail led, because I think that, you know, you and I are both feeling like the time and the moment to take a breather and to refill our fish ponds is now.
We're concluding this season 1. This amazing first season.
This is the completion of season 1.
So first I want to say congratulations.
Congratulations, Suze.
We're going to be using this time to refill our Spark Files and do a lot of listening and learning and hopefully making some space for other voices. We feel like we ourselves have a lot of studying to do in terms of some of the social change that is happening in the world, and we want to make room for other voices to rise to the surface in any way that we can.
And we can't be of service to anyone if we are depleted. And we very much want to be of service. We very much want this podcast to remain a place where people can come to get creative ideas, to get inspiration and run with it and take it and make it. And if we're feeling like we're at the bottom of our well, we need to refill it so we can keep giving back.
And we have so many things that we're working on and mm-hmm. so many things that we're studying on and so many things that we want to build for the future. So
we're scheming for season two.
We're scheming, but this will give us some real necessary time and space so that we can, you know, we talk the talk, but we've got to walk the walk. We've got to make time to do that work.
Yep, we do.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it, but I'm also looking forward to staying in touch with all of our listeners. You know, we will be on social media from time to time. You know, we're not going to disappear. We would love to hear what you're doing, what you're making, how you're resting or replenishing your own lives. We want to know all of that.
If you have sparks for us, if you want to replenish us,
please feel free.
I am so proud of us for a rocking season one.
Amazing 89 episodes.
That's a pretty good season one.
We're off to a good start.
Yeah, I'm super proud of us. I am super excited about resting, like super duper excited about resting. I am really excited after a little bit of rest to do all of the work that we, all of the plotting and scheming and the boots on the ground work that we want to do in preparation for not just season two, but all sorts of other exciting
The spark file
creativity.
The spark file world is going to grow and we're super excited about that.
So we'll be a little quiet for a while, but know that we are busy, creating more fun things for you all to enjoy in the future. So Camion, is there anything else we want to say? Did we say it all?
I think we said it all.
I love you.
I'm super proud of us. So much.
I celebrate us. We love our listeners. We celebrate you. We're quiet, but it doesn't mean we're gone. So just because we're quiet doesn't mean we're absent. We're just here working. You can still reach us. We love hearing from you. So we hope you will. We hope this put another bunch of sparks in your spark file. Mm-hmm. Should we take it home?
Let's take it on home.
Okay. As Camion said, if there's a spark you'd like us to explore in season two, or if you've taken a spark and fanned it into a creative flame and you'd like to share that, you know we'd love to celebrate you. And you can email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com, which Camion, you know I'm going to revamp on our break. You know that's one of the things I have to do.
That's on the list.
That's
on the list. I'm so excited about that. You also know that we will happily take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you got to share a creative risk that you have taken recently.
Yes. And you can follow us on social at The Spark File and be sure to subscribe, rate, and 5-star review this podcast. If you like this podcast, we hope you'll share it with people you love. There are so many episodes that are already in the bank that you can share.
89.
And if you didn't like it, good news, you get a break from us until September. What?
If something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we are writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take a spark and fan it into a flame.
We've got to listen and learn and let our phoenix burn. We're going to gather sparks and fill our hearts. And in September, we'll return. And in the meantime,
you gotta take it and make it. Oh,
we love you. If you can hear the sounds of our voices,
we love you.
And I love you, Camps.
I love you too, Blackwell.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark file. Could be something that I wanna make or how I wanna be.
I'll pump it in my spark file. I jump into my spark file. Let's open up the spark file.